We'll move to questions without notice, and I give the call to the honourable member for Wannon.
Thanks, Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Immigration. Last week, the minister claimed charges against hardcore criminals released from detention were being dropped due to a technical issue, quote, first identified late on Sunday, 10 March. Can the minister confirm that the legal issue was resolved by regulation on 8 December last year, and that the minister's subsequent failure to reissue valid visas for more than 3 months has led directly to dangerous criminals being released from prison?
Call to the Minister for Immigration, Citizenship and Multicultural Affairs.
Thanks very much, Speaker, and I thank the Shadow Minister for his question. And I say to him and every member of this House that every affected individual has been granted a visa with strict conditions. And I say to him and everyone here that there was no lapse in monitoring or coverage in respect of any individual. No change to our system of strict visa conditions. As he says in his question, the issue was a technical one, which we have resolved. The issue dates back to 2013 and existed for nearly a decade under the former government, who failed to fix it. And worse, they are playing politics as we get on with the job of fixing up the mess.
Minister completed his answer. Give a call to the honourable member for Dunkley.
Thank you, Speaker. My question is to the Prime Minister. How is the Albanese government, Labor government, working to help Australians earn more and keep more of what they earn?
Give the call to the Prime Minister.
I thank the member for Dunkley for her question and once again congratulate her on the fine honour, of following the late, great Peter Murphy into this chamber, and I wish her all the best. She knows, because the member for Dunkley has been talking to her constituents there about cost of living. In amongst the by-election campaign, with trucks, with scare campaigns, with hundreds of thousands of dollars spent on advertising promoting fear, the member for Dunkley went out there and talked to people about the issues that really matter to them. Spoke to them about cost of living, about how every taxpayer in Dunkley, and indeed every taxpayer right across Australia, will get a tax cut on July 1. Yeah. On July 1. And of course, with our tax cuts. And those opposite wonder why, when the legislation was carried, after they said they'd oppose it, then they'd fight it, then they'd roll it back, then they voted for it. Hasn't happened yet. Well, it'll be in the May budget, and it'll be in people's pockets every single week from July 1. All 13.6 million of them. And they continue to disparage it across the chamber, Mr. Speaker, to help those at home who can't hear the remarks going across the chamber. The average working woman in Dunkley will receive a $2,000 a year tax cut, something disparaged by those opposite, dismissed. Instead of getting precisely zero, which is what they wanted, for those workers in Dunkley earning under $45,000, they will get a tax cut too. But it's not just that, Mr. Speaker, because this morning we passed through the Senate the biggest boost to paid parental leave since it was created by the former Labor government back in 2011, increasing to 26 weeks by 2016, making it more flexible and more easily shared between mums and dads, so families can make the choices that are best for them and their kids. This will increase workforce participation. Good for families, good for children, good for the economy. That's the sort of measures that we are putting in place each and every day, because we want people to earn more and we want people to keep more of what they earn. We know those opposite want people to work longer for less. Well, that's not the Labor way. That's not what people in Dunkley voted for in March 2nd, and that's not what we will make sure that we work for each and every day.
Give the call to the member for Wannon.
Thanks, Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Immigration. The Solicitor General, Stephen Donoghue, told the High Court on 8 November 2023 that up to 340 people in long-term detention could be released as a result of the NZYQ case. Is that the number of criminals that the government expects to release as referred to in its secret briefing to journalists on Friday? Secret briefing.
Order. Order. Members. Order. Order. Members on my right will cease interjecting. The question was asked in silence. Order. The member for Lyons will cease interjecting. There's to be no interjections before I call the minister. The Minister for Immigration, Citizenship and Multicultural Affairs has the call.
Thank you, Speaker. I really do thank the Shadow Minister for this question and for his apparent newfound interest in legal matters, because today it's now 105 days since we offered a legal briefing on the issues going before this. 105 days, and we are still counting, Speaker. Now, at the time it was originally offered, they were too busy, to be fair. One of the Shadow Ministers was at Harvard on a study tour. Another one just could not escape the Sky Studios, and another was at the races. Now, as for the 104 days since then, I really don't know what they have been doing, except we can only infer...
The minister will pause. The members on my left will cease interjecting. I want to hear... Order! I want to hear from the member for Wanted on a point of order.
Relevant, Speaker. The question was about how many more hardcore criminals are you going to release?
Is it 100? Resume your seat. Order. There's far too much noise. The minister has the call.
He seems very well acquainted with this secret briefing, and I would encourage him. I would encourage him to be briefed on the real legal issues going to these issues so that he can make a constructive contribution to community safety. That he chooses not to do is frankly inexplicable, other than if he wants to retain some licence to free range on issues that he knows he is in the wrong on. Now, I can't get into the details of cases that are before the High Court, and I won't, but I will say this. I will say this. The government believes that these individuals, those who are not cooperating with their removal, should be removed from Australia as a priority, and if they, while they are not, they should remain in immigration detention. This is a position we successfully defended before the federal court. We will be vigorously defending this position before the High Court.
Before I call the member for Aston, I have a few acknowledgements I'd like to do for those who have joined us in the gallery today. I'd like to welcome to the House a delegation from the Parliament of Kiribati and the Public Accounts Committee, led by Chairperson the Honourable Tana Morahi. And on behalf of the House, I welcome you alongside a delegation from representatives of the Australian Political Exchange Council's 15th delegation from the Philippines. We also have guests from our friends at Oz Harvest who are joining us today in the gallery, and Mr. Dan McMahon from Shalom Catholic College in Bundaberg as guest of the member for Hinkler, and I see the former member for Brisbane, the Honourable Trevor Evans, joining us today. Welcome to you all. Order, and I give the call to the Honourable Member for Aston.
Thank you, Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Social Services. How will Labor's tax cuts work alongside other measures in the social services portfolio to support working families and strengthen their economic security? What has been the response to these measures?
Give a call to the Minister for Social Services.
Well, thank you, Speaker, and I'd like to thank the member for Aston for her question. And of course, the member for Aston, alongside every member of the Albanese Labor government, wants people to earn more and keep more of what they earn. And of course, this is evident with our tax plan, which from the 1st of July, every single taxpayer will be getting a tax cut, with 11.5 million Australians getting a bigger tax cut under Labor. But it's also evident in our historic paid parental leave legislation that has passed the parliament today. Now, as a result of our bill that has passed the Senate, from the 1st of July, working families will have access to more paid parental leave, with the scheme expanding by 2 weeks each year until we reach 26 weeks, a full 6 months in July 2026. Now, when fully rolled out, that's over $5,000 more in the family budget for 180,000 families each year. Now, of course, this builds on important changes that we put in place from July 2023, including to give more families access to the payment and by making it easier for more parents to share care. Now, I'm very pleased to see the strong support for Labor's historic reform from a diverse range of family, employer and community groups, unions, gender experts and economists. The ACTU has said the increase to 26 weeks was a great step forward for Australian parents, particularly working women, and a stark contrast to the policies and attitudes to women that we saw under the previous government. Of course, the Business Council of Australia said the expansion doesn't just help make a fairer society, but it's also a major economic reform which will help raise workforce participation and boost productivity. The Parenthood said that this is a significant improvement after no meaningful change to policy over the last decade. Quality Rights Alliance called these changes equality enabling and a significant advance in the promotion of Australian women's economic security. Now, while importantly the government is supporting parents to take time off after the birth or adoption of their child, we're also taking action to minimise the impact on their retirement income by recently announcing we will pay superannuation on government paid parental leave from July 2025. Not only is our government ensuring that women earn more and keep more of what they earn, but by paying super on paid parental leave, we are ensuring that women will retire with more as well. I hope that those opposite will join us to help us secure a better retirement as well as supporting women to earn more and keep more of what they earn.
The call to the honourable member for Griffith.
Question to the Prime Minister. Why is Labor refusing to phase out the big tax handouts for property investors, including the capital gains tax discount and negative gearing that benefit wealthy property investors like yourself and the 75% of Labor politicians who own an investment property?
Order. Order. The member for Griffith will cease interjecting. Just remind him not to reflect on members. Order. Prime Minister has the call.
Thanks very much. I thank the member for Griffith for his question. Look forward to his discussion in the party room with property developers in the Senate who are currently having proposals to carve through koala habitats in his party room. Yeah, exactly. That's fine. Our position with regard to housing is that the key to addressing housing shortage is supply. That's our position. That's our position. And that is why we have the Housing Australia Future Fund, which was opposed by those opposite all the way through and was opposed by the crossbenchers for a considerable period of time as well. But eventually they voted for it and allowed it through. But of course there is a bill before the Senate now, the Help to Buy bill, that's about putting people into home ownership. And that is a shared equity scheme, something that the Greens political party said at the last election was their policy. They actually went to an election saying it was their policy. But instead of that, of course, they are now opposing that move as well.
The Prime Minister will pause. The member for Griffith asked a question and the Prime Minister is giving reasons as to why. But I'll hear from. So it's going to be difficult. My point is, it's going to be difficult for you to make a point of order on relevance because of the way the question was phrased. You asked the question, why is the government refusing to do something? The government is answering, and the Prime Minister or the Minister is answering why that is. So I'll listen to you carefully, but sure. I'll just ask you to reflect on what I've just suggested.
With respect, Deputy Speaker, it's on relevance. I would say it's a.
Order.
A
Order.
A lot of worried order. Property investors, huh?
Order, order. Members on my right. Order. I'll just remind the member the Speaker is addressing him at the moment.
Thanks, Deputy Speaker. Speaker. It's on relevance.
Order. Order.
If I may. Thanks, Speaker.
Order. Order. Everyone gets two chances. All right. Member Griffith can state his point of order.
Thanks. Thanks, Speaker. A lot of worried property investors, huh?
Resume your seat. Resume your seat. No, doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way. You can't use and abuse a standing order like that. The Prime Minister in continuation.
Thanks very much, Mr. Speaker. I think that said more about the member for Griffith than anyone in this chamber. When it comes to the position, of course, the member for Griffith has said there isn't a housing supply problem in this country. Just last month, he said, there are 1 million vacant properties on the night of the census. I just want to be very clear, we have enough homes for people to live in. Apparently, there is no problem with housing supply in this country, according to the position of those opposite. Then, of course, we had the mishmash thought bubble of a policy announced just a week ago that didn't actually take anything positive forward. Of course, the Greens Party's 2002 election platform says this. This is why the Greens will establish a shared equity ownership scheme, the one they're not voting for in the Senate. But they do have a policy, Mr. Speaker, because they have said, the member for Griffith, that you shouldn't have to win a lottery to have a secure home. But then on the same website, he says, an example of the Greens' vision for housing in Brisbane is 2,000 homes available to any Brisbane resident and assigned by lottery. Mr. Speaker, you can't take them seriously until they come up with a serious policy. You can't take them seriously unless they actually vote for what they said at the last election was their own policy. It's there in the Senate, the Help to Buy scheme. They should vote for it and get out of the way of good policy, which is what this housing minister
order.
And this
Prime
government is proposing.
Give a call to the member for Gilmore.
My question is to the Treasurer. How is the Albanese Labor government's responsible economic management easing pressure on Australians while laying the foundations for future growth, and what approaches were rejected?
Call to the Treasurer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Speaker. Thank you to the wonderful member for Gilmore for her question. The member for Gilmore understands that despite the welcome and encouraging progress that we have made on inflation, we know that people are still under cost of living pressure. And that's why we put so much time and effort since we've come to office into putting downward pressure on inflation in our economy. And it's why we are pleased, Mr. Speaker, that quarterly inflation is now around a third of what we inherited from those opposite, Mr. Speaker. Now, a key reason for that is the way that we've gone about managing the budget and the economy in the most responsible way. We have taken pressure off inflation by running a tight budget, the first surplus in 15 years. We turned a $78 billion deficit into a $22 billion surplus. We've seen the fastest and best recovery in the budget bottom line in the G20 comparing the year before we were elected to the year after we were elected. And all of this is saving us on peak debt and interest costs, Mr. Speaker. And this is why the IMF, the Reserve Bank and others have pointed to the way that our budget policy is working hand in hand with monetary policy. It's also why the OECD and the Australian Bureau of Stats have gone out of their way to say that our policies are directly reducing inflation in our economy. That's because we designed our cost of living help to take pressure off inflation rather than add to it. And we know the combination of energy bill relief, early childhood education reform and rent assistance took something like 0.5 percentage point off inflation last year. And we know that our tax cuts won't add to the inflation problem either, and it won't add to deficits, but it will boost labour supply in our economy, Mr. Speaker. Now, as the minister said a moment ago and others have said, the Prime Minister, getting on top of inflation, getting real wages moving, rolling out the tax cuts, paying the super on paid parental leave, as Linda White and Peter Murphy urged us to do. All of this is about ensuring people earn more and keep more and retire with more as well. And the reason why the new member for Dunkley sits on this side of the House and not on that side of the House is that we have a plan to ease cost of living pressures, and they don't, Mr. Speaker. They don't. If they had their way, inflation would still be galloping, wages would still be stagnating, there'd be debt and deficit as far as the eye can see, and people would be working longer for less, Mr. Speaker. And the Dunkley by-election show and their behaviour today shows that their nasty negativity is no substitute for economic credibility, Mr. Speaker. Almost 2 years in and they still have no alternatives except for the economic insanity of their uncosted nuclear fantasy, Mr. Speaker. We reject their approach. We're managing the economy. We're managing the budget responsibly. We're making progress on inflation and real wages. We are repairing the budget. We are laying the foundations for growth. And we are cleaning up the mess that they left behind.
Has concluded. Order. Members on my left. I hear from the member for Wannan.
Thanks, Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Immigration. Over the next 6 months, how many foreign criminals will finish a custodial sentence and be released into the community instead of going to immigration detention?
Call to the Minister for Immigration, Citizenship and Multicultural Affairs.
Thanks very much, Speaker, and I thank the Shadow Minister for his question. And I remind him and remind the House that what we are talking about here arises from a decision of the High Court. A decision, indeed, that we argued strongly against, but one that any government, like any government, we must oblige to follow the law and comply with the orders of the court, which we are doing. In relation to the question he asked me a moment ago, I dealt with some of the steps the government is taking to ensure that we are doing everything possible to keep the community safe in this context. Throughout this, we have been guided by community safety, and that is why we've put in place four layers of protection.
The minister will pause. The member for Wannan on a point of order.
Speaker, it's on relevance. It was a very tight question. How many foreign criminals will finish a custodial sentence and be released into the community instead of going to immigration detention? That is a very tight question, Speaker.
In your opinion, I understand the answer that you're seeking under the standing orders. I know you'd like a number, there'd be an exact, but under the standing orders, the minister needs to make his answer directly relevant. So as long as he remains directly relevant, I can appreciate when it comes to yes-no answers or figures under the standing orders, there's no direction I can give the minister to answer the question you would like it to be delivered in, but I will make sure under the standing orders he is directly relevant to the question. So the minister will continue and will remind him to remain his answer directly relevant to the question that he was asked.
Thanks, Speaker. What this question shows is again exactly why the Shadow Minister is uninterested in the legal briefing, because he prefers fear to facts. Fear to facts every time.
I'll just ask the minister to return back to the question.
He well understands the issues that he would be briefed on, and that is why he is choosing not to be briefed by legal people.
Give order. The House comes to order. Members on my left, give the call to the honourable member for Blair.
Thank you, Speaker. My question to the Minister for Aged Care. How is the Albanese Labor government helping aged care workers earn more and keep more of what they earn, and how will this improve the quality of care following the Royal Commission?
The call to the Minister for Aged Care and Sport.
And I thank the member for Blair for his question. He is a tireless advocate for aged care residents like Margaret at Cabanda Care at Rosewood that we visited together just last week. The Albanese government wants all Australian workers, including aged care workers, to earn more and to keep more of what they earn. because we know that strong, sustainable wage growth is part of the solution to cost of living challenges, not part of the problem. And that's why we backed aged care workers in their fight for better wages at the Fair Work Commission. And we delivered a 15% increase to award wage minimums for 250,000 workers, an $11.3 billion investment in the people who dedicate their working lives to caring for older Australians. Under the Albanese government, registered nurses are now taking home an additional $196 a week, or $10,000 a year. Personal care workers are now earning an additional $141 a week, or an extra $7,300 a year. That bump in their weekly pay packet is changing the lives of workers, which in turn changes the lives of the people that they care for. Paula, a registered nurse in aged care, told me just this weekend, "Thank you for not only improving our wages, but for improving the quality of care and the time that we get to spend with our elderly. They appreciate that too." And Paula is right. Our investment in aged care workers is paying dividends for the people that they care for. Under the Albanese government, older people are receiving an additional 2.16 million minutes of care per day. There has been a reduction in the number of pressure injuries, reduction in the number of physical restraints, reduction in significant unplanned weight loss, falls, polypharmacy, and the use of antipsychotics in aged care. Wow. We are also seeing improvements in the star ratings data, with fewer 1- and 2-star ratings facilities and more 4- and 5-star rated facilities. But we don't just want workers to earn more, we want them to keep more of what they earn.
That's right.
From 1 July, every single taxpayer, including aged care workers, will receive a tax cut. So not only can a registered nurse like Paula take home $10,000 more under the Albanese government, she will now get a tax cut of $1,679 from 1 July under Labor's tax cuts, almost double what Paula would have gotten from the coalition.
Good call to the honourable member for Fairfax.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question goes to the Minister for Climate Change and Energy, and I refer to Labor's new family car and ute tax and the minister's frequent comparison to the scheme in the United States. Between 2004 and last year, vehicle emissions in the US decreased at an annual rate of 1.4%.
The member will pause for a moment. I just want to hear the point of order.
The question's about asking about a government policy that doesn't exist. In terms of hypotheticals, it's actually not.
Order. I'm sure the minister will be able to deal with the premise of the question as he sees fit. I'm just going to ask the member to continue with his question.
Will I start again, Mr. Speaker?
No. You just continue where you were. Order.
Vehicle emissions in the US decreased at an annual rate of 1.4%. In contrast, the minister's scheme requires an annual reduction of 12%. That's a rate nearly 8 times higher. Why is the minister again fudging the numbers and punishing everyday Australians?
The member may care to resume his seat. Before I call the Minister for Climate Change, I want to hear from the member for Warringah on a point of order.
A point of order, Mr. Speaker, in relation to Standing Order 100, Rules for Question D. 3 and 4, Roman number 3 and 4, that a question must not contain inferences or imputations. I would say that the member's question was in breach of that standing order.
The member for Warringah is of course entitled to raise a point of order, and we have had this issue raised in the previous couple of weeks of Parliament. The difficulty I have is that the examples and what practice have shown over decades, the type of question that has been asked by the member has been asked for a very long time. So there are numerous examples of where the argument raised in the question has been put to various ministers over the time. The minister has the opportunity now to disagree, agree with the premise of the question or what's in the question. And if we were to start applying this directly, indeed, everyone's questions would be in focus, which, if that's the will of the chamber, we can look at, but I think even questions from the crossbench would fall under that as well. On the point of order?
Respectfully, Mr. Speaker, though, this does go to a question of principle of the standing orders. That there is a purposeful mischaracterisation of a government policy that is in breach of these standing orders. It either means the standing orders are pointless, or they are being belligerently ignored on the assumption that the standing orders won't be applied.
Well, the member is, of course, entitled to her view around the standing orders. It's my job to ensure that they are enforced and in line with practice and what has happened for some decades now of how questions have been asked, and I'm happy to send her examples of that over the time. It would assist everyone if everyone could refresh every question and ensure that Standing Order 100 doesn't include arguments, inferences, imputations, insults, ironical expression or hypothetical matter. So whilst I'll note what the member said, this question is in order. The member is entitled to ask, just as everyone is entitled to ask their question, and the minister will now be entitled to respond to the question. The minister has the call.
Well, thanks very much, Mr. Speaker, and I really do thank the honourable gentleman for his question. And the question goes to bringing Australia in line with the policies in other countries. And that is a fair point for the honourable member to make, because it is the fact that Australia and Russia are the only two major economies without vehicle efficiency standards in place. The United States has had them in place since the mid-1970s, introduced, to be fair, by a Conservative administration. President Ford, Gerald R. Ford, introduced vehicle efficiency standards in the United States at the time. Now, it is the case, Mr. Speaker, that we have considerable catching up to do with the rest of the world, because the rest of the world has been introducing these standards and because Australia has been so late to the party when it comes to introducing these standards. Because several governments have tried, but until now, no government has followed through and delivered for Australian motorists. Now, I've been reflecting over the parliamentary break, Mr. Speaker, and I think I've been unfair to the member for Bradfield, because I have pointed out his strong support for vehicle efficiency standards, but I think an observer could reach the conclusion that he was the only one on the other side. And to his credit, he is a strong supporter of vehicle efficiency standards, but he wasn't the only one. Indeed, of course, he had joint carriage with the then member for Kooyong and with the then member for Flinders, the member Mr. Hunt. He took it through Cabinet on several occasions. To his credit, everyone who was in Cabinet at that time in 2016 and 2017 obviously signed it off. Obviously, the Leader of the Opposition would have been in favour. There was a joint media statement, big gold crest on the media statement, joint media statement from all three ministers. And it said, in relation to the honourable member's question about international standards,
The minister will pause. The minister was asked a question about why he's pursuing this policy. He is giving context as to why he's pursuing the policy. So I'll hear from the, just like the member for Griffith, I'll give the same advice to the member for Fairfax. He's entitled to raise the point of order.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The question went to the minister's comparison to the United States and the scheme he is introducing. The order is one of relevance. The question went to the United States having an annual reduction of 1.4, he's requiring Australia reduce it by 12% on an annual rate.
Can you resume your seat? Order. The Minister for Skills and Training will cease interjecting. A minister needs to make sure his answer is relevant, and it was containing a number of detailed analysis by the member for Fairfax. And it finished with the question about why is the minister pursuing the question. So I'm just going to give him the call to make sure he's being relevant to that part of the question, and he can deal with the others as he sees fit.
Certainly, Mr. Speaker, and I certainly appreciate the guidance, because Australia does have a lot of catching up to do with the United States, for example, who introduced these standards in the mid-1970s. And we are seeking to catch up with them, yes. And that means we are ambitious. We are ambitious, Mr. Speaker, not for ourselves, but for the choices of Australian people to catch up with the United States. We're not the only ones. The member for Bradfield said in this statement, and it's directly relevant to international comparisons, he said, although Australia accounts for less than 2% of the global new vehicle market, it is becoming increasingly important
that we harmonise our approaches to vehicle emissions with those in place in other countries, which is exactly what we are seeking to do. We're not seeking to catch up with New Zealand or Europe, which have more ambitious standards. We are seeking to catch up with the United States. And it is the case that dated in the 1970s, we are trying to implement them in 2024, which comes considerably too late when you consider that John Howard went to the 2001 election promising, and I quote, "The coalition is negotiating new fuel efficiency standards for motor vehicles to reduce the amount of fuel consumed per kilometre travel." The Liberals kept talking about it. We will deliver it.
Give a call to the honourable member for Solomon.
Yeah. Thanks, Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Indigenous Australians. Minister, how is the Albanese Labor government improving housing, creating jobs, and economic opportunities for Aboriginal Territorians?
Call to the Minister for Indigenous Australians.
I thank the member for the question. He is very familiar with the issues of jobs, economic development, and housing in the Northern Territory. Last week, I visited Alice Springs, Darwin, Catherine, and the small community of Binjari. People are so excited about the new remote jobs and economic development program and the possibilities it brings. It will create 3,000 real jobs in remote communities with proper wages and proper conditions. It will build the remote workforce and boost regional economies. At the Kalano Community Association, just outside Catherine, I saw for myself innovation in action, where I met two young men. They've joined the remote jobs trial that makes swags territory essential, apparently. The long-term plan is to develop a local swag-making business. It's an idea that's come from the community and is being led by the community. I also spoke to women from nearby Rockhole who are working in the deadly kitchen, making healthy meals, nutritious meals, using an electric fry pan, a very sensible idea in remote Australia. At Binjari, I joined the Prime Minister to announce a historic investment to improve housing in remote Northern Territory. The joint funding with the Northern Territory Government will see up 270 new homes built each year for 10 years. Importantly, it will also fund repairs and maintenance. Reducing overcrowding means better health, keeping children and families safe, allowing children to focus properly on school. In Binjari, we met Stevie, Stuart and Stephanie, who had just moved into their new home with good design, environmental sustainability and disability access. They are so happy. Decent housing and more opportunities to work are fundamental to closing the gap. It brings pride and it also brings employment, local employment. As Sky Thompson, the CEO of Aboriginal Housing Northern Territory, said, "This is an investment in people. This will ensure Aboriginal Australians across the Northern Territory are able to live with dignity and pride." She also said, "Where their kids can grow safe, healthy and strong and truly look to their future with real hope and optimism."
Before I call the member for Parks, I just want to inform the House that present in the gallery today are representatives from the Government's Youth Steering Committee who are concluding their terms after working to improve whole-of-government youth engagement. And on behalf of the Minister for Early Childhood and Education, we welcome you to the House. Give the call to the honourable member for Parks.
Thank you, Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Climate Change and Energy. Toyota's Vice President of Sales, Sean Henley, claims that Labor's proposed new family car and new tax is too aggressive, stating, "I can tell you from Toyota's perspective, we're not buying credits. We'll pay a fine. We'd pass it on." When Labor's new family car and tax proposes penalties of around $14,900 for a Hilux, $11,000 for a RAV4 and $25,000 for a Land Cruiser, how can the minister claim the prices of existing cars will not go up?
Order. give the call. The member for Fisher will cease interjecting. I give a call to the Minister for Climate Change and Energy.
Well, thanks very much, Mr Speaker. I thank the honourable member for his question, and I can tell him that because his constituents do drive long distances, they have a lot to gain from more fuel efficiency in the fleet, Mr Speaker. A constituent of his in Broken Hill, for example, would save $1,080 a year, Mr Speaker, if they buy a new car in 2028 as a result of this government's policies.
Order. Now, Mr Speaker, on my left, the member for Hume will cease rejecting.
No, they are really sending a memo to the Australian people, aren't they, Mr Speaker? They did not hear the lessons of 2022. The only thing missing from the honourable member's question was an assertion that they don't tow your boat, and they won't tow a caravan, and they'll end the weekend, Mr Speaker. You list a bit out of the question because that's the mindset of those opposite. The member for Cook has left the building, but he's left the policy manual for those opposite. Now, the fact of the matter is, Mr Speaker, that we have catching up to do with the rest of the world. Motorists in the United States, in New Zealand, in Canada, in India, in China, in Saudi Arabia have the benefit of new vehicle efficiency standards. Because of 10 years of denial and delay in action, Australians don't. Those opposite know we should. The member for Bradfield knows it. He was a very fervent advocate for them, and he pointed out on multiple occasions that in no country in the world has there been an upward impact on any particular model, and he was right then and he's wrong now.
Call to the honourable member for Bean.
Thanks, Speaker. My question is to the Attorney General.
Order. Order. The member for Bean will continue with his question.
How will the Albanese Labor Government's Administrative Review Tribunal bills clean up the mess left by the former government?
Give a call to the Attorney General. Attorney General has the call.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. I do thank the member for Bean for his question. And yes, the stacking of the Administrative Appeals Tribunal under the former government was a sight to behold. As many as 85 former Liberal MPs, failed Liberal candidates, former Liberal staffers and other close associates of the Liberal Party were piled into plum jobs with the AAT without any merit-based selection process on salaries worth hundreds of thousands of dollars. They did it again and again, including on the eve of the last election. Decisions of the AAT have life-changing impacts for thousands of Australians, from people with a disability seeking support through the NDIS to vulnerable families trying to get the right social security payments. Australians count on the AAT to get a fair hearing. But the Liberal Party didn't care. The stacking of the AAT by the Liberal Party was shameless. It just went higher and higher. Like the world's most perilous game of Jenga, stack after stack, and it resulted in a tribunal that was entirely dysfunctional. And I hope you heard the earlier part of my answer. The backlogs out of control, people waiting months or even years for review of a basic AAT decision. Just like a game of Jenga, it all came tumbling down. Well, the Albanese government does care about Australians who are struggling. We do care about their rights to a fair and independent process and to have a system they can trust. We wasted no time on coming into office to start fixing the mess that those opposite left. The legislation that I introduced last year, in December last year, developed in consultation with people who use the system every day, would abolish the AAT and replace it with a new administrative review body that is user-focused, efficient, accessible, independent and fair. The legislation requires that members of the tribunal be appointed through a competitive, publicly advertised, merit-based process. Our commitment to this is already on display, with more than 100 new appointments made already through our merit-based process. The Administrative Review Tribunal Bill will be debated in this place this week. I thank the House of Representatives Standing Committee on Social Policy and Legal Affairs, chaired by my friend, the member for Macquarie, for its suggestions on how the bill can be improved, and to the stakeholders who have engaged constructively with my office on these issues. We're committed to getting
the
this right.
The Attorney General's time has concluded. Give a call to the honourable member for Mayo.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Aged Care. My electorate is concerned by the Aged Care Task Force report and your previous comments that the baby boomers are coming. Minister, those in receipt of aged care services already contribute to their care. Why is it fair for older Australians to pay more when we don't means test other supports, such as the NDIS? Isn't this just age discrimination?
We call to the Minister for Aged Care and Sport.
I thank Member for Mayo for her question and for her long-standing and diligent interest in policy for aged care and improving that standard across this country. As she probably observed keenly when we released it last week, the release of the Aged Care Task Force is an important next step, but it is a step in the journey on our aged care reform in this country. It is the Aged Care Task Force, which we set up mid last year, worked for 6 months and did a huge amount of consultation, including with people from her electorate. There were 11 roundtables held from task force members themselves and an additional 12 roundtables that were held by both OPAN, the Older Persons Advocacy Network, and CODA, Council of the Ageing, who held roundtables on the terms of reference of the task force with their members specifically, so that the people that they had on the task force could feed that back in for discussion. Additionally, there were 180 submissions made, there were numerous webinars, so we have 6 months' worth of consultation where those questions and contributions have been made and considered by the task force, and you would have seen last week, last Tuesday, the 23 recommendations that the task force has made to government. Now, the report of the task force does not represent the government's response. The government is now considering our response to those 23 recommendations. What we have done so far across the couple of months that we have had that report is been able to advance our work to the point that last week we could give older Australians some certainty about the pathway we would take forward. And what we were able to say was that we would rule out any new levy across Australians, any new tax on Australians, and any changes to the arrangements for the family home, which I hope gives some of the constituents that you're speaking about this with some confidence and certainty about what this pathway looks moving forward. Now, what we do to move forward is continue to work through this within the processes that we have in government. In order to do that, it also means that we have commenced meeting with the opposition about whether there is a pathway for us to do this in a bipartisan manner. Certainly, you would have seen in the opposition leader's budget reply last October last year that this is something that parties and crossbenchers from all parts of this parliament consider to be something that should be above politics. Better aged care in this country should be above politics. So the early responses that I saw from people last week is that there may be a pathway forward for us to do this in a bipartisan manner. I think that your constituents would find that to be both reassuring and something that they would expect of us to be able to do in this parliament. We have offered some briefings so far to members of different parties and crossbenchers in this place. We will continue to do that as we move this work forward. And I will, of course, update the House on progress as soon as I'm able to do so.
Give a call to the member for Adelaide.
Thank you, Speaker. Speaker, my question is to the Minister for the National Disability Insurance Scheme. How will Labor's tax cuts benefit those working in the disability sector? And what else is the government doing to ensure sustainability in the NDIS and to make sure every dollar is going to participants who need it?
Give a call to the Minister for the National Disability Insurance Scheme and the Minister for Government Services.
I thank the member for Adelaide for his question. There's about 400,000 of our fellow Australians who work in disability care. They're very hardworking, and as we meet here, they're looking after some of the most vulnerable people in our community, ensuring they have good quality of life and that they're getting the support they need. Most, if not just about all, disability workers earn less than $150,000 a year. So whilst they deserve the thanks of the people here in this House, they also deserve some good news. And the fact of the matter is that under the Labor government on July the 1st, this hard-working cohort of Australians are going to get good news. Thank goodness
Labor changed the tax policy to make sure that disability workers and many other workers under $150,000 are going to get fair income tax cuts. A disability support worker on about $75,000 a year, they're going to get $1,500 more back in their tax next year. An occupational therapist on $110,000, they'll get north of $2,000 extra because of Labor's tax cuts. So when you look at how disability workers are faring under Labor, it's a very successful trifecta. There's the tax cuts on 1 July. Wages under Labor have moved 11.2% for disability carers. And as an added bonus, the superannuation is going up. So disability workers are getting overdue recognition only under a Labor government for the hard work they do. But the member for Adelaide also said what creates a more sustainable NDIS. And disability care workers deserve a more sustainable NDIS so they can have good careers in the future. One of the big challenges to a more sustainable NDIS is, of course, fraud. This Labor government, the Albanese government, has been taking real action to clamp down on fraud in the NDIS. Over the last year, the crime task force that Labor established in late 2022 has been looking at the operation of plan managers in the NDIS. Unfortunately, whilst there's 1,500 plan managers, too many do not have the best interests of participants at heart. Some are very good, there's no question. But plan managers handle $22 billion of payment and they charge $500 million for it. But the problem is that once the NDIA and the task force forward to the tax office the records of the at-risk cohort of about 900 plan managers, 343 came back from the tax office with problems. There were no records, they're not paying, they're not declaring their income. The Labor government is determined to make sure that we can keep this scheme sustainable. And I noticed a couple of interjections from some of the coalition backbench. One of the problems of keeping the NDIS sustainable, and we've had good support from the front bench, is that former Minister Reynolds said that this government too quickly invokes its crackdown on fraud and we're too focused on fraud.
Call the Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker.
The member for Canning can resume his seat.
Ask further questions be placed on the notice paper.